Senator Taylor's testifying in committee. She'll be here shortly. Let's start with a public hearing on Senate Bill 163. Chris Alanak.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 163 makes two changes. It increases the earned income tax credit from current law, which is for the most part 8%, although some taxpayers, if they have a young dependent, can get an 11% credit. The bill changes that to 15% for all taxpayers. That's 15% of the federal credit. And then the other change, that's in Section 1. And Section 2 of the bill doubles the personal exemption credit. And the personal exemption credit in 2017 is $197, so that would double it to $394. The bill has $90 to $180. That is the initial amount that's indexed to inflation, so that's why it's much larger in 2017. The personal exemption credit can be claimed by all filers. Under, if you're single, you need to have income up to under $100,000, and for joint filers, income under $200,000, and there is one credit allowed for every for the taxpayer and each dependent. So a family of, say, four can claim four personal exemption tax credits. And both of these tax credits would take effect in, or the changes would take effect in 2018. The personal exemption credit is one of the three credits that does not have a sunset date, and the earned income tax credit has a current sunset date of January 1st, 2020.
Are there revenue impacts on either of those sections? Or?
I took a quick look at it for ballpark figures. The increase of the EIC would be between $40 and $45 million a year. Again, that would just be for 2 years, 18 and 19, because the bill does not change the sunset date.
Just 45 per year?
Per year. And the doubling of the personal exemption tax credit would be about $525 million a year.
Okay.
Those are just kind of back of the envelope estimates.
Okay, and we have some people to testify on this. Matt Newell, John Mullen, Philip Kennedy Wan, and James Bart, if you all want to come up at the same time.
It doubled the credit.
Good morning, Chair Haas, members of the committee. My name is Matt Newell Ching. I'm with Partners for a Hunger-Free Oregon. I'm joined today by members of an informal coalition that has been working to support improvements to the earned income tax credit. I'll let these fine gentlemen introduce themselves in just a little bit. Partners for a Hunger-Free Oregon envisions an Oregon that is hunger-free, healthy, and thriving. Oregon is the only state in the nation that saw a statistically significant increase in its rate of hunger when the last data from USDA came out back in September. That means that families are increasingly having to choose between things like their food budgets and their budgets for rent. The earned income tax credit is an incredibly valuable tool for Oregon's working families to escape poverty. Along with the child tax credit, 129,000 Oregonians were lifted out of poverty between 2011 and 2013, including 65,000 children. Almost 300,000 Oregon households received the earned income tax credit in 2014. So I'd like to speak to the merits, particularly of just the section on the earned income credit. I won't be addressing the personal exemption credit. We wholeheartedly endorse and support an increase in the state's match of the federal earned income tax credit. As was mentioned before, we are currently at 8% with families under three. Families can receive a credit that matches at 11%. I should note that there are 26 states in the nation that provide a credit, provide a match to the state credit, and Oregon is one of those states. The Oregon could certainly be doing better. Iowa recently improved its credit to 15%, just like this bill would do. New Jersey recently increased its credit to 35%, a 35% match, so that's significantly higher than Oregon's. Massachusetts raised its credit to 23%, so I think there's a significant amount that we could do to improve this credit, and I'll let these fine gentlemen add on to these thoughts. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, John Mullen with the Oregon Law Center. The Oregon Law Center has long supported the state earned income tax credit. In fact, we worked on the initial creation of the state level earned income tax credit. Our coalition that Matt has talked about sort of went into hiatus, but we reformed. Going back in history, our coalition supported an earned income tax credit of 18%. As high as 18%, and there have, of course, been other discussions in the building from time to time. The Morrison-Schrader tax plan had earned income tax credit up to 25%. I say this because in the larger context of what you might do around revenue, one of the things that we'll be interested in following and advocating on is any regressive features of taxation to be able to boost the earned income tax credit to help people. So an example would be if you decide to have a transportation plan that increases the gas tax, that will hit low-income people especially hard. And so the idea of increasing the earned income tax credit makes sense. I want to just also mention the personal exemption. I think this bill is interesting that it's doing two separate things that are really not necessarily connected. In other words, at lower income levels, boosting the personal exemption would certainly be fine with me, but I don't know in my household if we need that doubling of the personal exemption. We do make under that threshold of $200,000 joint filing. And when you take a look at the price tag of just creating that a change to the personal exemption, Chris had figured it's in the neighborhood of $500 million. So that's a big increase to consider, where the more modest increase, about $40 to $45 million for an earned income tax credit, would be in play. Certainly, if there is a discussion about changing the personal exemption, I would certainly favor having it be geared towards lower income people, maybe along the same standard of the earned income tax credit for the cutoff for income. But beyond that, we want to thank the committee for giving consideration to the earned income tax credit and consideration of some of the larger issues as you look at revenue reform. Thank you.
Chair Hass and members of the committee, for record, Philip Kennedy Wong, Oregon Food Bank, and I want to begin by thanking the committee for having a hearing on the earned income tax credit. I'll keep my comments brief because much of the points that I wanted to cover has already been covered. I will say it would be, we would love to see this bill passed in conjunction with a prior bill you had heard that would increase the utilization of the earned income tax credit for eligible low-income tax filers that have sort of, I think you've heard earlier in the session, there's a high percentage of Oregonians that either are not aware of their eligibility for their income tax credit, or they do not understand how to file for it. I think by increasing the earned income tax credit and increasing the awareness, it would have the intended effect of helping those who are at risk of poverty or hunger to be able to acquire additional resources. Thank you.
Chair Hass, members of the committee, my name is James Barta. I'm the legislative director for Children First for Oregon. And my points about EITC being very important to get children out of poverty have been made by the person to my right. And my concerns about expanding their personal exemption in these tight budget times have also been made. And then my hope to increase the utilization rate of EITC, since we're, I believe, third lowest in the country, have it also been made. I just will then add that EITC is indeed a successful program that is on the children's agenda, that is supported by a broad coalition of groups, and is one of the few anti-poverty programs that I know is supported by Democrats and Republicans alike. So I hope that it is part of any final revenue and budget negotiations, because Oregon can indeed do better.
Comments or questions, Senator Boquist?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Don't take this wrong, but I disagree. I don't think the earned income tax credit has been successful at all. And my both personal and professional observation is that while we're trying to move this direction in economically and economicist ways, this makes the best sense and the most efficient way to deliver it. I mean, the fact remains both the state and the federal departments of revenue, Internal Revenue Service, are doing their damnedest to make sure that people don't get this. But that being said, and we have discussed previously about quarterly refundable and how to apply this, but a more fundamental question for all four of you to answer, and I'd like an answer for each of the four of your organizations, is that I don't disagree with you that the hunger study says there's more hunger. I don't disagree with you that the poverty says there's more poverty. Yet at the same time, our fine economists outside of this building and all kinds of other people are talking about the booming economy, the increasing wages, we increased minimum wage. All these great things are going out here. And in fact, the reality is, I don't know, the haves are getting more and the have-nots are getting less. Help me out here, how our statistical analysis is driving us right into the ground to failure, yet supposedly everything is great out there simultaneous to that. And what you think we could do to improve the earned income tax credit to actually make it work the way all of us think it ought to work.
Chair Hass and Senator Boquist, I can speak to part of your questions. You know, Oregon Food Bank, you know, we are a 20 regional food bank network that serves 950 small agencies across the state and various communities. And when the recession started, we were distributing roughly around 64 million pounds of food across the state. Today, we're distributing roughly 90 million pounds of food. And so for us, we are still serving food at what we would call recession levels. And it's having a lot of challenges for us to acquire all the necessary resources. And so just a few things. One is that we see having tools like the Earned Income Tax Credit as necessary to supplement the work that we're doing as far as hunger relief. And second, we also see a few other things. Like, I think based on the last economic forecast, you know, with the state economist saying that we've had, you know, job growth. In fact, we've had consecutive job growth. But we're still seeing, I think, people who aren't essentially earning enough to be able to make everything they need to make in order to, you know, cover their basic needs. And let me just clarify, because I know some of you have had some questions about how we define the hunger rate. So for folks in the food bank world, we look at hunger under two definitions that the USDA, defines or uses. One is low food security, and the other is very low food security. And for both of us, I mean, for both of those definitions, for us, it still means hunger. Low food security means just that people who are looking for food, but they can't guarantee they're able to access, all of their food needs in a single week. And the higher intensity is the very low food security, and that's people who not only do not know if they can cover all of their meals in a week, they know the quality of the food that they have access to is very limited. So since we serve both, I will use the term hunger to describe both, and I know that can be a source of confusion for some folks. But having said that, what we do find are people who are coming in with either part-time jobs or, you know, jobs that are like, not essentially covering all their other needs, whether it's like rent or healthcare or whatever, and they're still accessing food through our system. So we're just seeing it from a reality sort of standpoint. So I can't speak to why there is supposedly a disconnect that you have pointed out, which we fully experience in terms of our demands. I will say that the data that we have from the USDA is a 3-year average. So there could also be a potential lag, but I'm not a statistician, so I can't explain that from an academic standpoint.
Mr. Chair, Senator Boquist, to your question, I think this is a really great question to raise about a variety of other policy issues that we're taking into consideration. When we look at a number of benefits that have cliffs to them, and thinking about things like SNAP benefits, but also looking at what happens with cutoff for eligibility for Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act and whatever might happen in the future. So the Oregon Law Center's mission is to achieve justice for Oregon's low-income communities, and we would personally love it if there was less of a need for the earned income tax credit because all of these other policy issues were working in sync. I think one of the things that has been the case when we look at temporary assistance for needy families programs, for example, it can lag behind changes in the economy. It takes a little bit of time before we see reductions in caseloads. We're seeing reductions in caseloads now in the TANF program, which is a really good thing because we use the savings reinvested back into the program. So I think that there are signs of progress, and I would certainly like to see lots more progress. But while we are still struggling, or people at the lower income level are still struggling, I think the earned income tax credit is a very good tool for helping people to be self-sufficient. One final comment I'll say is that some of the most compelling testimony I ever saw on the earned income tax credit is from one of your former colleagues, Representative Betty Comp, that talked about what the earned income tax credit meant in her situation for her family. So I think it always helps to be able to bring those points clear when you look at what the effect is on an individual household and then think about what it may mean for many others.
Senator Boquist, members of the committee. So a couple things in addition to what my colleagues had just said. You had mentioned the possibility of doing quarterly installments, if I heard you correctly. One issue that we've experienced when states have tried this, and there was formerly the option to do this, is that for many low-income people who are juggling two or three different jobs, who also have fluctuating hours, it is difficult to predict with accuracy what your total income annually is going to be. And so you can project that at the beginning of the year, but your hours shift. You take on an additional job, you subtract a job, family status can change. And what we don't want is a scenario where taxpayers owe a significant amount thinking that they have claims, anticipated that they're going to claim, the amount that they had forecasted when, in fact, family circumstances have changed. And so that's one of the reasons why we don't want taxpayers owing, a significant amount coming the following April. Another quick point is that the hunger data that I cited earlier was a moving average from 2013 to 2015. So when you cited the minimum wage change, for example, that had not gone to effect reflecting that data. So we certainly would hope that that incomes would rise there. Having said that, the data that I've seen from the State Economist has shown that while jobs are increasing, the number of family wage jobs, we're still struggling to really meet the needs for families. And with housing prices on the rise, that's actually one of the reasons that we have seen the rate of hunger increase, is because the housing prices are increasing, and families are increasingly having to choose between paying for rent and paying for food. So this is when a family receives their earned income credit, we see them spending on basic necessities. We see them spending on things like improving a car. Sometimes it can mean first or last month's rent. Sometimes it can just mean paying bills that are previously owed. It can be a repair to a house. It can be any number of significant things. It can mean going back to school so that they can improve and earn higher wage jobs. And there's also a significant amount of data to show that that families are only on their income tax credit for a couple of years at a time, and that they phase off precisely for the reasons that John mentioned, that it is in fact a perfect slope. There's no cliff to, so there's no disincentive for higher earnings.
Chair Hess, Senator Boquist, appreciate the question. As you can see, there's lots of different responses because it broaches into why like in the state of Oregon is child poverty higher than it was before the recession? It has gotten better the last few years, but we still haven't even gotten back the gains that we had back in 2007. And I'm of the opinion that, you know, it's many of the factors. You know, the minimum wage hasn't really kicked in for these families. We're seeing a structural change in the economy in that there's fewer middle-income jobs. You know, we see growth in high-income and low-income jobs. And so that's one of the things that is forcing families into poverty, even when they're working. And housing prices across the country have gone up. And I'm of the opinion that that's due to federal policies 30 years ago that dropped affordable housing by the federal government by 70%, you know, affordable housing subsidies. And so all these factors together are pushing against these families who are working multiple jobs and trying to make things fit together. And I'm hoping that some of the policies that we've done, including any EITC expansion, will indeed help lift those families and children out of poverty. And as a side note, just the way we measure poverty is so antiquated. You know, it's from the late 60s based on how much food costs. And in fact, housing and medical costs have grown much faster. And so a person at 100% of the poverty level today is in a much tougher shape than they were, you know, 100% of the poverty, you know, 30 years ago as well. So it's part of a continuing discussion that I look forward to having.
Senator Burchard.
Thank you. I guess this question is probably for Mr. Kennedy Wong. Could you describe to this committee how you appropriate the food? I mean, who can get the food from the food bank?
Chair Hass and Senator Burchard, thank you for the question. So we have a couple of things in place. So first, let me first explain that where our food comes from, and it's a diverse sort of set of resources, and each one set of those sets, one group of those food does have some requirements. So let me say what they are. So first, we get food from the private sector. So that comes from food drives, but also comes from the food industry. And those would be essentially, you know, like a food processing, you know, business wanting to donate a bunch of cans of foods or something like that. But it also includes farmers that want to donate. And then we have also food that we have to purchase, like foods that are staple items that we're not getting enough in terms of donation. So we raise money to purchase those foods. And then the final category, what we would call federal food commodities, that's called the Emergency Food Assistance Program, or TFAP, as some folks call it for short. Those foods are the foods that have some requirements because they come from the federal government. And that requires for us, when we distribute it to our 20 regional food banks, and then they in turn deliver it to the 950 small agencies, that the end agency that receives that food for at least the federal food commodities, before they distribute it, they have to require the recipient to self-declare what their income level is. So that is the one requirement for that set of foods. But the other foods I mentioned previously, that's essentially for us, it's up to that local agency to self-determine how best to distribute it. So as long as they are distributing it in a manner where the food is safe for consumption, you know, it's kept in a safe place, so on and so forth. And also they don't, discriminate based on who, you know, they want to give the food to versus who they don't want to.
So at the end of the day, anybody in this hearing room could show up at the food bank and get food, no questions asked, basically.
Chair Hass and Senator Burchard, well, yes. I mean, it is based on an honor system. We, you know, hope that, you know, the smaller nonprofits that receive our food, and most of them are our churches or food pantries or nonprofits, that they are essentially, you know, entrusted with the food that we give them to make the right decisions on as to how their resources that we've shared with them are distributed.
Thank you. Okay.
Any more testimony?
No.
This is the end of the hearing?
This is the end.
Good, then I do have something.
Senator Brockwitz?
I just want to make an observation, and gentlemen, thank you for answering the question, but you didn't answer it. So I want you to listen to my statement and take it away, because I am quite supportive, and I'm the one who suggested in committee we should go to quarterly, and I would disagree. We could make a quarterly earned income tax credit work, because it's a better way to deliver services than we are now. Since 2009 and 11 budget, in which we cut $5 billion in real dollars, not growth, real dollars out of that budget, we've then had record expenditures at the state level, yet we are issuing out record benefits. We have record obesity. We have record hunger. As to the food bank, I see the same problem that my good colleague to the right is, and I'll just say, I know Republicans who make more money than I do. Of course, the legislative salary is not much. I do know that, okay? Then go to the food bank every week, and they're driving a $60,000 SUV, the Republicans. They have a $500 iPhone. They have manicured nails, and they're not the ones that need those items. And somebody's lying on inflation, and everybody in this room knows that, because inflation's officially at 2%, yet if you go to buy foods, I go to the grocery store every Friday, $5 Friday at Safeway, good time to go, folks. Okay. But the fact remains, you know, we're not making any headway here. And we need to do something drastically different than what we're doing now if we're going to make headway and we're going to address poverty and we're going to do it in an economical method. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm off my soapbox.
All four of you work on outstanding missions, so keep up the good work. We're trying here. Thanks. I'm going to close the public hearing on 163. We're going to open up a joint public hearing on these next two bills. They both deal with property taxes and seniors, so I will open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 160 and Senate Bill 700.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, while Kyle's coming up for the next one, 160 it creates a personal income tax credit against in an amount where property tax is paid for eligible individuals. An eligible individual is somebody who is age 65 or older and has income under $40,000, and there is a threshold income. There is a credit that is 50% of the amount of property taxes above 10% of their income. So, for example, if somebody has $30,000 of income, that 10% threshold is $3,000. If their property taxes are $4,000, then the tax credit is 50% of that difference of the $1,000. So they would be eligible for a $500 tax credit. And Kyle's going to talk about the next one.
Okay. Sorry, I didn't know you guys were split up on these.
It's okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, picking up where Chris left off, Senate Bill 700, it essentially creates a property tax freeze for qualified seniors. What it would do that by establishing a limit on the total amount of property tax liability due for senior homesteads. It would abate the taxes in excess of the taxes that are frozen. So it frees it in the year prior to when the claim is filed, and then going forward, the taxes would be the same in years 3, 4, 5, and years forward. To qualify, an individual has to be 65 years of age or older at the time that the claim is filed, and their primary sources of income have to be from fixed income sources. It does allow the limit to be transferred to new homesteads once every 3 years. I did include in the background of the SMS an example, a hypothetical example, but if you're thinking of an average property, might have a tax imposed of $3,000, and they would file the claim in the initial year, and then in the first year since the claim is filed, since that freeze went into place, you'd expect savings of about, it's up there on the screen, $90 in year one, in year two, $183, and then going forward. And that's just based upon the taxes would be $3,000 based on what was paid or what was imposed the previous year. The following year, they'd be $3,000. The year after that, they'd be $3,000, and they'd stay at $3,000 as long as the individual continued to qualify.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Ryman.
Thank you. And you're saying that it's anyone who's on a fixed income, and it doesn't matter how big that fixed income is?
No, Senator Riley, there's Yes, it just says primary sources are fixed income, so there's a little bit of specificity that is not contained.
Thank you.
I don't want to lose a bill with a senator to my left here, but I know some people on fixed incomes that are pretty bloody high, okay?
I know. Yes.
Okay. Let's start with Bill Newell is here.
Good morning. My name is Bill Newell, and I work for Senator Tim Canope. I think we had a good overview of what the bill does. I also want to say that it specifies that only the first 10 acres which hold the homestead are also allowed to gain the exemption. I think that's line 14 on page 1 of the bill. So thank you for the opportunity to testify on behalf of this bill. I think the goal is to mainly help seniors who are living on a fixed income, people who are often on government assistance such as Social Security, stuff that they've paid into before. It's meant to be narrowly tailored at a specific group of individuals who aren't necessarily able to go out into the workforce and earn more money to take into account the rises in property taxes and things like that. In addition to the fact that a lot of people are experiencing a situation where their cost of living is going up, food prices are going up, and basic necessities are going up, but their income isn't able to commensurately go up with that. And yeah, as was said earlier, you must be 65 years old or years of age or older. You must be living on a fixed income, and the individuals must apply for it. It isn't just blanket granted, you have to apply for relief. So basically, it's an opt-in scenario. As you noted, there may be issues that people have with the bill. What is a fixed income? I think that would be a wonderful place to add a nice definition so that we could get more specificity out of it. I would also say that you could means test it, so you could add an income threshold to it, because there are individuals who get capital gains income, you know, they have investments and things like that, that, you know, they're probably earning more than the average person, and maybe they don't necessarily need this type of relief, and we would hope that they also wouldn't apply. You could also change the age limit. You could have it tied to Social Security at the national level, so whenever they're playing with the retirement age, that could go up in step with national policy, so that there's some level of coherence and nature to the bill. I think the goal here is to mainly just focus on people who they have been taxpayers their whole lives. They have been working a lot, very hard. They have families. They've paid for their homes, likely, and they're continually being asked to pay more and more on their homes, and they're not able to actually go out into the workforce and earn the extra income necessary to pay for all of the stuff that they need to pay for as human beings, which we all have to pay for. I'm happy to take any questions that the panel may have.
Questions? Thank you. Gilbert L. and Tom Rolfing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Gil Riddell, Association of Oregon Counties. AOC opposes Senate Bill 700. It would grant property tax relief for homesteads of seniors on fixed income. The goal is laudable, but it carries difficulties and questions, both practical and fundamental. Tom Rolfing will address the practical issues. I want to note, though, that AOC assumes that this bill is standalone and will not be part of a comprehensive public revenue reform package. If it is, that would be analyzed separately as a whole. The bill raises a fundamental governance issue. Oregon has an imperfect state-county shared services and revenue system, but we work to improve it. Shared services are strikingly visible in the color table that you see. The red's the largest portion. Those are the shared services. They're born from historical agreements. between the state and counties. Typically, when a county relinquishes taxing or jurisdictional authority in exchange for state revenues from that source. Examples are cigarette taxes, beer and wine taxes, video lottery revenue, county forest trust lands revenue, gas tax, and assorted regulatory fees. The immediate needs for state revenue often trump historical state-county shared revenue agreements. The legislature has the power to do this in certain instances, in spite of the offense to prior agreements. Witness the sweeps of 2009. Senate Bills 700 and 160 are two excellent examples of how our relationship should or should not be done. If this is sound statewide public policy, why does the bill use critical local property tax resources to pay for it? Other states use income taxes, such as a refundable tax credit. Contrast Senate Bill 160 as an example of a more appropriate approach to state property tax expenditures. Income tax in Oregon is the major revenue source for the state. The bill imposes state policy. Oregon's rate-based property tax system has already been cut, capped, and limited to benefit the property owner, and it represents a straight loss for essential local public services. The Task Force on Comprehensive Revenue Restructuring in 2009 made this short-term recommendation: refrain from new property tax expenditures on local governments. This recommendation is directed at the legislature and essentially says do no harm that will make local government's fiscal situation worse. There's also a statute, 306-350, which is a clear legislative statement of respect for the county, state-county shared revenue and services system. It provides that when a new property tax expenditure, that's an exemption or a special assessment, is created or an existing property tax expenditure is expanded, 50% of the amount of that foregone revenue to non-school local governments will be appropriated into the property tax expenditure fund account and distributed to the affected local taxing districts. The exceptions are if the loss is offset by repealing or restricting another property tax expenditure, extension of the operating period of an existing property tax expenditure, or local option. Governor's Task Force on Federal Forest Payments and County Services in 2009, in Recommendation 40, asked that this fund be sufficiently provided with appropriations. The account has never been funded. Although introduced in good to serve a good purpose, Senate Bill 700 would impose new local administrative costs, violates the state-county partnership, and has an inappropriate funding source. We hope that you reject it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Chair Haas, members of the committee, my name is Tom Rolfing. I'm the Marion County Assessor. I'm here today in place of Doug Schmidt. He said you've seen him too much lately. So I'm here representing OSACA, the Oregon State Association of County Assessors. OSACA has chosen to oppose Senate Bill 700. This bill is another complication of our Oregon property tax system. It would create significant amounts of work and cost for the Department of Revenue and local county assessor's offices. So we already have very complicated assessment CAMA systems you've probably heard about before. This would require additional programming and so forth that we haven't dealt with before. I'll hit a couple of the highlights. We already have Measure 5, which limits property tax rates. We have Measure 50, which limits the assessed values. And this would be a limit to taxes, an abatement, which would require additional complexity in the system. So it would limit the amount of tax on all or a portion of a unit of property containing a homestead. Mentioned 10 acres, limited to 10 acres of a property. Another question it hasn't been addressed in the bill is what 10 acres. You can imagine a large unit of property and some of it could be specially assessed, some of it could be in other programs, some could be higher value than others. So what specific 10 acres of the property would we be talking about? Let's see, property tax districts would not necessarily be equitably impacted. You know, we have greater concentrations of seniors in different counties. Some of our ONC counties that rely on the ONC timber funding, which has dwindled significantly. Some of those counties have higher populations of seniors. A question I had, if an application is made once, and does the administration of the program, does the property stay in the program until there's some discovery that no longer would the property qualify? We have some changes over time where properties are more and more difficult to actually have access to. And people aren't always home if someone was to physically inspect to see if it was qualifying. And who would verify the use of the homestead? How would the use be verified and how often? I noticed in Doug Schmidt's testimony that he submitted to this committee that he points out some serious issues with bond rate calculations and payments. For all of these reasons, we ask the committee not to move this bill forward.
So other than those problems, though, you're okay?
Absolutely. There's some questions.
Questions from the committee. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you. And Mark Garce is here from the Department of Revenue.
Chair Haas, members of the committee, Mark Garce with the Oregon Department of Revenue Property Tax Division. We're neutral on the policy of providing some property tax relief to seniors, but we did have some administrative concerns with the bill. As Senator Knope's aide said, we're pretty concerned about the definition of the primary source of income being fixed income. It'd be nice if we had some sideboards around not only what fixed income meant, but also what primary meant in that context. The eligibility standards allow for you to transfer the benefit from one property to another, which could result in some pretty odd situations if you move from a county, say, with much lower values into a county with much higher values. You could just get some really odd results where people are paying very low burden for a relatively expensive home. In our senior deferral program, we have a downsizing provision where you're able to move into a home with a lower real market value. So if you wanted to allow those kind of transfers, you might consider that. The applications are filed to the assessor, who then transfers them to the Department of Revenue. We've done some kind of back of the napkin numbers, and we think that as many as 300,000 folks might be eligible for this program, which could be quite a bit of resource that we'd need to process those applications. As was stated by the assessors, we're not entirely clear whose burden it would be to actually figure out whether or not folks were using these as their primary homestead, but we figured that we would probably do something similar to what we do in the deferral program. The bill does not include a sunset, and so we think it'd be subject to the automatic six-year sunset. I think our biggest concern really is how the taxes are actually supposed to be frozen. It isn't really specified in there. If we were to reduce them the way that we reduce compression, for instance, it would go first to the local options and then proportionally off of the rates of the other districts. But the way that it's written now, it almost seems like it would apply equally to general obligation bonds, which could create some real issues as far as bond calculations go. So we'd be happy to work with the sponsors of the bill on addressing some of these issues. But as it's written right now, we have some pretty serious concerns.
Questions of the Department of Revenue. All right. Thank you, Mark.
Thank you.
All right. I'm going to close the hearing on Senate Bill 160 and 700. It clears out our agenda today. There is an issue with seniors, low-income seniors, and property taxes. It should be addressed somewhere along the way. Maybe it's in our big bill. Maybe not.
We've got a relating clause.
Keith. Don't scare us here, Senator Bertschinger.
Mr. Chair, the
the key thing you said there is low income. We can make sure that we put that in the bill.
Make sure that all the blanks are filled in. Paul? Okay, we will adjourn until 8:30 tomorrow morning. Until 8:30 tomorrow morning.